For this Monday, June 22nd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. Two more members of the campaign advance team who attended the president's rally in Oklahoma on Saturday have tested positive for coronavirus. The campaign confirming that now eight members of the advance team have COVID-19. And it follows new questions on the crowd size in Tulsa, which did not meet expectations set by the president or his campaign. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate's Republican leader setting up a key vote Wednesday for that GOP police reform bill. Senator Mitch McConnell will need 60 votes, including the support of at least seven Democrats, to overcome the hurdle. He's urging Democrats to allow the bill to advance. We'll have live coverage on C-SPAN 2. A number of key primaries tomorrow, including in Kentucky and New York, which will shape the fall congressional races. We'll get some background from Max Greenwood of TheHill.com. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with the very latest on coronavirus. Nearly half the country, 23 states, are reporting a rise in new COVID-19 cases over the last 2 weeks. And of those, eight states are experiencing a spike of 100% or more. For example, in Florida, now topping 100,000 confirmed cases, with nearly 3,000 new cases reported just in the last 24 hours. Governor Ron DeSantis over the weekend saying that the vast majority of these cases are among younger, asymptomatic people. Arizona surpassing 50,000 confirmed cases yesterday. And Houston could become the new hotspot, with health officials there warning it is quickly becoming the worst affected city right now in North America. Yesterday, the World Health Organization reporting its largest single-day increase globally, the U.S. alone accounting for more than 20% of those new cases, according to an analysis by the New York Times. From Geneva, Switzerland, there was this from the Director General of the World Health Organization.
It seems that almost every day we reach a new and grim record. Yesterday, more than 183,000 new cases of COVID were reported to WHO, easily the most in a single day so far. More than 8.8 million cases have now been reported to WHO, and more than 465,000 people have lost their lives. Some countries are continuing to see a rapid increase in cases and deaths. Some countries that have successfully suppressed transmission are now seeing an upswing in cases as they reopen their societies and economies. All countries are facing a delicate balance between protecting their people while minimizing the social and economic damage. It's not a choice between lives and livelihoods. Countries can do both. We urge countries to be careful and creative in finding solutions that people stay safe while getting on with their lives. We continue to urge all countries to double down on the fundamental public health measures that we know work. Finding and testing suspected cases works. Isolating and caring for the sick works. Tracing and quarantining contacts works. And protecting health workers works. At the same time, these measures can only be effective if each and every individual takes the measures that we also know work to protect themselves and others. Maintain physical distance, continue cleaning your hands, and wear a mask where appropriate.
And Dr. Tedros is the Director General of the WHO, and of course his comments come as many cities, including here in Washington, D.C., begin to gradually reopen. New York City now moving into phase two of its reopening, allowing restaurants to begin outdoor dining, retail stores to open with in-person shopping, and offices to resume operations at half capacity. In fact, city officials there saying as many as 300,000 employees expected to return to their workplace in Midtown Manhattan. And in Los Angeles, LAX Airport rolling out a new pilot program that uses thermal cameras to detect those passengers with fevers of 100.4 degrees or more. And at the White House, the president refusing to say whether he told staffers to slow down on COVID-19 testing to make it look like the U.S. had fewer cases. It was a claim he made Saturday at his campaign rally in Tulsa. We carried it live here on C-SPAN Radio. During an interview for Scripps Television, this question from reporter Joe St. George.
On Saturday night, you said that you told your staff to slow the testing down to improve the numbers. Does that mean someone watching this right now on their local news is not going to get a test because you asked your staff?
We do more testing than any country in the world by far. 25 million tests. Other countries do 1 million. Every time you do a test, as you do more tests, it shows more and more cases. So we're so far advanced, both in terms of the quality and the amount. And we're doing all these tests, and it shows cases. If other countries aren't doing, or if we did slow it down, we wouldn't show nearly as many cases. You're showing people that are asymptomatic. You're showing people that have very little problem. You're showing young people that don't have a problem. But we're doing so much testing, 25 million tests. Nobody thought that
was
possible.
But did you ask to slow it down?
If it did slow down, frankly, I think we're way ahead of ourselves, if you want to know the truth. We've done too good a job. Because every time we go up with 25 million tests, you're going to find more people. So then they say, we have more cases in the United States. The reason we have more cases, because we do more testing than any other country by far.
Again, not the president, but the headline from that interview, he refused to answer the direct question. The interview with Scripps Television, bringing some follow-up at today's White House briefing with the press secretary.
Daly, thank you. Has the president actually directed officials to slow down the rate of coronavirus testing?
No, he has not directed that. And in fact, I would note that first, we continue to test about 500,000 per day, about 500,000 people per day. $1.8 billion is invested in NIH to find new testing capabilities. Any suggestion that testing has been curtailed is not rooted in fact. I would just note the extraordinary efforts of this administration, more than at this point, 26.7 million tests, and we should be north of that.
When he said Saturday that he told his people to slow it down, what did he mean by that?
The president was trying to expose what the media oftentimes does, is they ignore the fact that the United States has more cases because we have more testing. We are leading the world in testing, and he was pointing that out, that it's a fact that the media readily ignores.
So what he's saying that he told his people to slow down testing is not true?
It was a comment that he made in jest. It's a comment that he made in passing. Specifically with regard to the media coverage and pointing out the fact that the media never acknowledges that we have more cases, because when you test more people, you find more cases.
Is it appropriate to joke about coronavirus when 120,000 people have died?
He was not joking about coronavirus. I just said he was joking about the media and their failure to understand the fact that when you test more, you also find more cases.
Haley, thanks so much. To follow up on that, has the president ever delayed the allocation of federal funding that's already been dedicated to national testing?
No, on the contrary, the president has led the way to make us the leading country in the world on testing. In fact, the FDA has authorized 144 tests under EUAs, emergency use authorizations. These include 122 molecular tests, 21 antibody tests, one antigen test, and the president has led the way in making us the world's leader with regard to testing.
The administration sitting on about $14 billion of funds that have been approved, but not yet allocated.
Well, I just mentioned the $1.8 billion at NIH that's there, and we're exploring new testing. We're leading the world in testing, and we will continue to do so.
That with Kayleigh McEnany from the White House press briefing earlier today. But as you heard from that exchange, Senate Democrats do say that the Trump administration has yet to distribute nearly $14 billion that Congress has provided for expanding coronavirus testing as well as contact tracing. In a letter to Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, Senator Chuck Schumer claiming that the Trump administration has not released a plan to distribute more than $8 billion out of the $25 billion provided by Congress in April to expand that testing. And on the Senate floor, the Democratic leader also responding to the president's weekend comments in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
At his inadvisable and very poorly attended rally in Tulsa on Saturday, President Trump said that he told his administration to, quote, slow the testing down, please, unquote, so the number of COVID cases won't look so bad for him. Amazing. He said that. Don't learn the truth about a serious and deadly disease so he might look better. He went on to say that testing was a double-edged sword. Let me break the president's statement down for a moment. By calling testing a double-edged sword, the president means that on one hand, testing could be good because it, you know, who tells you who has COVID-19. But on the other hand, testing might not be so good because the more cases makes the president look bad. Who thinks like that in the time of a raging pandemic? White House officials tried to claim the president was joking, But today, the vice president denied that they were just in jest, calling them, quote, a passing observation, whatever that means. Regardless of whether he was serious or not, the president's comments are factually inaccurate. The increase in testing is not responsible for the increase in the number of cases. In fact, the rate of positive cases is going up in many states, which means community spread. There is a lie sitting at the heart of all of this. President Trump wants Americans to believe that the number of cases is going up because his administration has done such a great job on testing. The truth is, the administration can't even get around to spending the money Congress has provided for improving testing and tracing. Senator Murray and I sent a letter to HHS Secretary Azar last week asking him why the administration hasn't disbursed the $14 billion we gave it to ramp up testing and tracing capability. $14 billion is just sitting there, waiting for the Trump administration to use to help our country.
From the Senate floor earlier today, Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York and the White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow on CNBC this morning saying that a second wave of coronavirus is not coming and that lawmakers will likely develop another stimulus package by the end of next month. Those two headlines from the CNBC interview. Here's a portion.
Over the weekend, there are 37 states that have virtually no problems. There are 13 states that do have hot spots. By the way, part of that is massive new testing. We're running 500,000 tests per day, so you're going to pick up some. But I was just interested. I was going through it this morning. Some of the hot spots that you probably have talked about, Arizona, no question about it. Florida, no question about it. Nevada, North Carolina, Oregon, Texas. But on the other hand, Becky, just to balance it out, I'm looking at this Colorado down 30% here, the Washington, D.C. metro area down 31, Illinois down 36, Massachusetts down 27, Michigan, that's really something, they're down 80% on case rates. So, you know, there are some hot spots. We're on it. We know how to deal with this stuff now. It's come a long way since last winter. And there is no second wave coming. It's just, you know, hot spots. They send in CDC teams. We've got the testing procedures. We've got the diagnostics. We've got the PPE. And so I really think it's a pretty good situation. Fatality rates, incidentally, fatality rates continue to decline. Looking at the 1 day and 7 day fatality rates, less than 0.5%, even while, as you noted, cases have gone up in some places. So all in all, I think it's a pretty good situation. And of course, reopening the economy is the key to economic growth. And we've had a whole bunch of green shoots that are showing recovery probably coming on faster than a lot of people thought.
That from Larry Kudlow earlier today. His interview available online at CNBC.com. And at the NY Times headline at NYTimes.com, the president's shock at the rows of empty seats in Tulsa. Maggie Haberman and Annie Carney writing the following, quote, President Trump and several staff members stood backstage and gazed at the empty Bank of Oklahoma Center in horror. The president and Vice President Mike Pence had canceled plans at the last minute to speak at an outdoor overflow rally that was almost entirely empty, despite claims of nearly 1 million people registering for tickets to attend the event in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the president's false boast of never having an empty seat at one of his events. The president had been warned aboard Air Force One that the crowds inside the arena were smaller than expected. He was stunned and yelled at aides backstage while looking at the endless rows of upper blue seats in the upper bowl of the stadium. That, according to four people familiar with what took place. Brad Parscale, the campaign's manager who had put the event together, was not present. That story from the New York Times this evening. But the campaign says the crowd size, now officially estimated at about 6,200, was closer to 12,000. Tim Murtaugh is the communications director for the Trump campaign. This earlier today on Fox News.
How can you have a million people RSVP that they're going to come, as the campaign said, and only 6,200 show up? How do you explain that disparity in numbers? As that, the campaign's the one that put out those numbers.
First, we know how many people went through the magnometers that are set up by the Secret Service, and it was 12,000, so the fire marshal is wrong. But secondly, Brad's par scale statement is exactly accurate. We went through more than a week's worth of constant negative media coverage from cable news networks, mostly offensive would be like, say, CNN and MSNBC, telling people that the most dangerous place in the world that they could be would be at a Trump rally, first because of the coronavirus, and second because of the threat of dangerous protesters outside. And normally a Trump rally is filled with a lot of families. A lot of kids come to Trump rallies. I've been to several dozen Trump rallies, and there are always children in attendance. In Tulsa, there weren't any children at all, really. And it's because we believe they were frightened away by more than a week's worth of 24-hour-a-day negative coverage telling people that the Trump rally was a dangerous place to be. And the fact that 12,000 people still showed up, I think, shows a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for the president. And first thing he said when he got on stage is he called everybody in the arena warriors, you know, and I'm told that the lower bowl of the arena holds 9,000 people, and it was full. Any reporter who was there would know that it was full, and there were some people in the upper deck as well. So the fire marshal's estimate is wrong. And against this deluge of negative scare tactics by the media, because they don't want President Trump back on the campaign trail. They don't want him holding rallies. And so they did everything that they possibly could
to keep people away. Certainly, but wait, I got to jump in before we run out of time here. Okay,
sorry,
and ask you, how many people do you think it is that go to a Trump rally who watch MSNBC or CNN? I don't think those are a lot of people
just,
that watch
look,
those networks and then
that.
Would show up
constant,
in person.
It was every cable news outlet. It was all of the newspapers. It was all of the news media's websites. It went on. I mean, it's undeniable that for more than a week, the entire national news media was dead set on discouraging people to go from going to President Trump's rallies. It's because Democrats and the mainstream media don't want President Trump on the campaign trail. And let me tell you, we had 12,000 people in the BOK Center, and that's approximately 11,990 more people than attended Joe Biden's last event. There is a gigantic enthusiasm gap between President Trump and Joe Biden. It is real, and it is wide.
That exchange with Tim Murtaugh of the Trump-Pence campaign on Fox News, and joining us on the phone is Alex Eisenstadt, who is covering the campaign for Politico. And first, bottom line, how many people were inside the arena Saturday evening? What was the count?
Well, it depends who you ask. Now, if you ask the Tulsa fire officials, they'll tell you that 6,200 people turned up. If you talk to the Trump campaign officials, they'll tell you that thousands more showed up. It's hard to tell. There are contradictory accounts. But what is clear is that there were a whole lot of empty seats. Tulsa officials say that more than half of the seats were empty. Campaign says that about a third of the seats were empty. So it all depends on whose count you're talking to and who you want to believe.
Regardless, the campaign set this up as a major rally. Brad Parscale, who's the campaign chairman, said that the president for the first time would hold a rally outside and then inside the arena. Of course, that wasn't the case because the crowd never materialized.
The crowd never materialized, and perhaps what was most embarrassing for the campaign is that they said that there would be over 1 million people who had signed up for this. And that really raised expectations. And it kind of just fell flat on its face, obviously, sort of, which kind of heightened the sense that this was a real disappointment for the campaign.
And as you point out, this rally, in your words, meant to be a turning point for the president's campaign. So where does this put the Trump reelection effort?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You talk to top Trump officials, and they'll tell you in pretty straightforward terms that these last few weeks were really the lowest point for Trump's presidency. Coronavirus, the racial unrest, he really hit the lowest point of his presidency, and he's trailing now Joe Biden fairly substantially in an array of battleground states. So this was going to be a really important moment for the campaign. They were really going to try to turn their focus to Joe Biden. They were, you know, they had just gone up with an air, taking aim at Biden over his mental capacities. Trump was going to pound away at the former vice president on that issue and others. But instead, the event was really overshadowed by several things. One, these issues about the crowd or the lack thereof. And also just the tangents that Trump went on in his speech. He referred to coronavirus as Kung Flu. He talked about how he had pushed to slow down coronavirus testing. His people later said that he was joking about that. He spent a lot of time doing an imitation of how he – doing a rendition of how he descended the stairs at the West Point commencement speech and how he drank water during that commencement speech. So a lot there was a lot that he did in terms of going after Biden, which is what his advisors wanted him to do. However, a lot of that was just overshadowed by the antics of this event.
We're talking with Alex Eisenstadt, his piece Inside Trump's Oklahoma Debacle. It's available at politico.com. You sat down with the president last week. What was your takeaway?
Well, what really struck me were a couple of things. One, he did something that he rarely does, which is he admitted a sense of political vulnerability. He said that mail-in ballots are the real risk, the biggest risk for him in this election. I thought that was really interesting, given that this is a guy who doesn't concede anything. But he seemed to acknowledge here that he was very vulnerable in this election. The second thing that I thought was really interesting was I asked him about what would happen if you have Republican senators in swing states or blue states, of which there are several, running for re-election in election, you know, this year, who, what if they start to distance themselves down the stretch, if they start to feel like Trump is a weight on them? What would happen then? And Trump was very, very straightforward. He said, look, they're going to lose. And he rattled off the names of other Republicans who, during the 2018 midterm cycle, distanced themselves from him, all of whom never returned to the Senate. I thought this was a really important moment because it showed that Trump is trying to send a real warning signal to anyone thinking about crossing him.
Alex Eisenstadt, his work available at politico.com. He's covering the 2020 campaign. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
On C-SPAN's The Weekly, author, columnist, the co-founder of the American Conservative, and advisor to three Republican presidents, our conversation with Pat Buchanan, who has played a key role in previous winning presidential campaigns and twice sought the GOP nomination for himself. He offers this advice to President Trump in his 2020 re-election effort.
There's two things he has to do, I think, to be successful. Number one, the economy's got to continue on sort of the V-shaped curve that it started back up on. That has to happen. Secondly, there has to be no second wave of this coronavirus, because I think the country would be so despondent if it broke out again in September and October that it might say we just have to change.
Pat Buchanan joins us on C-SPAN's The Weekly. You can find it on our free radio app or on the web at cspan.org/podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review us, and remember to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. And welcome back to Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that through an executive order, the president is temporarily barring new immigrants on a slate of employment-based visas, including the H-1B for those highly skilled workers, preventing them from coming to the U.S. amid the coronavirus pandemic. Administration officials say the move will safeguard jobs for unemployed Americans. And in case you have not been counting, Axios.com has been, today marking 103 days since the last Major League Baseball game, Major League Basketball game, the NBA, football with the NFL, or an NHL game, the longest such drought since the fall of 1918, that, of course, amid World War I and the last major pandemic, the Spanish flu. Earlier today at the White House, Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany defending the administration's abrupt firing of one of the government's top prosecutors, seeking to downplay the president's involvement. The press secretary facing multiple questions over the ouster of Jeffrey Berman, who is the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. He had been overseeing investigations into a number of Trump associates. Here's how that unfolded inside the White House briefing room.
Kenny, the president and the attorney general over the weekend offered different explanations behind the firing of Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Can you clarify now why Berman was dismissed and if it was at the president's request?
Well, I think that they were very much in sync this weekend, the Attorney General and the President. And here is what happened. The President held Mr. Clayton in very high regard, wanted to nominate him to this position in SDNY to keep him in the government as he returns to New York. Barr was working on a smooth transition, and when Berman chose to respond in the way that he did, he came to the President, and the President agreed and fired this individual, Mr. Berman, as Mr. Clayton now will in time get to that position.
Why was Mr. Berman being dismissed in the first place?
Because Mr. Clayton wanted to go back to New York City. We wanted to keep him in government, and therefore he was given the position at SDNY.
But why did the President, I have two questions, but why did the President say he wasn't involved in the firing of Jeff Berman when the Attorney General said the President was the one who fired him?
Because the Attorney General was taking the lead on this matter. He did come to the President and report to him when Mr. Berman decided not to leave. And at that point is when the President agreed with the decision of the Attorney General and to fire Mr. Berman and to promote Mr. Clayton.
So he was involved in it then?
He was involved in a sign-off capacity. He was not, A.G. Barr was leading the way, but in a sign-off capacity, yes, the President was.
That from today's White House briefing, and Clayton is Jay Clayton. He is currently the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Meanwhile, the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer calling Attorney Berman's firing, quote, corrupt, and that gives the impression that the president interfered in an ongoing criminal investigation into himself and his associates. Senator Schumer sending a letter to the Justice Department's internal watchdog asking for an investigation into Berman's firing. And another New York Democrat, the House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler, saying yesterday he is sure that Berman will testify before the committee about the events leading up to his termination. If and when that hearing happens, of course, we'll be covering it for the C-SPAN networks. In the Senate, look for a key vote Wednesday on that Republican policing bill. Mitch McConnell saying he is scheduling it before the July 4th recess. The GOP bill would try to require police departments to ban the chokeholds and includes new reporting on the use of force by police, also the use of the no-knock warrants. It also includes new penalties for any department not using body cameras and has requirements on law enforcement and their records retention. There's also a separate bill that makes lynching a federal hate crime. Here's more with Senator Mitch McConnell.
Now, in recent weeks, the Democratic leader and many of our colleagues on the other side of the aisle have insisted over and over and over again that they wanted to consider legislation on this subject prior to the 4th of July. My friend, the Democratic leader, repeatedly expressed how eager he was to consider these issues here on the Senate floor. But now, Mr. President, we read this. Senate Democrats are agonizing over what to do about Senate Republicans' police reform proposal. What's there to agonize over? And this, Senate Democratic leader faces a tough call on whether to let a Republican-backed police reform bill advance on the Senate floor. Agonizing? Tough call. It seems to me that proceeding to consider Senator Scott's legislation, proceeding to take up the subject on the Senate floor, would only be an agonizing prospect if members were more interested in making a point than in actually making a law. For anyone who actually wants to legislate, shouldn't be a difficult call to vote to begin considering Senator Scott's legislation. It will be exactly the vote which this moment demands. Last week, I understand the Speaker of the House herself said we'd like to end up in conference on police reform legislation. The only way to do that would be for the Senate to pass a bill. Even the Speaker does not seem to understand why Senate Democrats would block this chamber from even considering the Justice Act.
From the Senate earlier today, the Republican leader, but as you heard from Mitch McConnell, Democrats have warned that this legislation does not go far enough to change the nation's law enforcement system following the death of George Floyd and other African-American men. Here is Democratic leader Chuck Schumer earlier today.
Our Republican colleagues have responded to our comprehensive proposal with an approach that is piecemeal and half-hearted. And the longer you look at the Republican policing reform effort, the more obvious the shortcomings and deficiencies. The Republican bill does nothing, to reform the legal standards that shield police from accountability for violating Americans' constitutional rights. The Republican bill does nothing, to encourage independent investigations of police departments with patterns and practices that violate the Constitution. The Republican bill does nothing, to reform the use of force standard. Nothing on qualified immunity, nothing on racial profiling, and nothing on limiting the transfer of military equipment to police departments. The Republican bill doesn't even truly ban chokeholds or no-knock warrants. It leaves major loopholes when it comes to chokeholds and only requires more data on no-knock warrants. More data would not have saved Breonna Taylor's life. Allowing police to use chokeholds whenever they say that deadly force is necessary is not going to save lives. We need a bill that achieves genuine police reform. The Republican proposal comes across like a list of suggestions. I would repeat this important warning. If we pass a bill that's ineffective and the killings continue and police departments resist change and there's no accountability, the wound in our society will not close, it will fester. This is not about making an effort or dipping our toes in the water. It must be about solving a problem that is taking the lives of too many Black Americans. This is not a time for studies or commissions or tinkering around the edges. This is not a debate about tax policy or transportation policy. It is a matter of the constitutional rights of the American people.
And so that from Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer. Again, a reminder, the debate and the vote scheduled for Wednesday. We'll have it live on C-SPAN 2. On ABC's This Week Yesterday, one of the five Sunday programs we carry every Sunday afternoon here on C-SPAN Radio is a rebroadcast. The lead author of the GOP Senate bill, Tim Scott of South Carolina, and this exchange with anchor Jonathan Carl.
I was struck by one place that praised your bill, The Root, which is a African-American-oriented liberal online magazine, said that the GOP bill is more likely to stop cops from killing Black people. And they go on to say that the bill would enforce its provision by reducing federal grant money that is already available to state and local law enforcement agencies. Scott wants to prevent departments who don't comply with the law from continuing to receive these funds. And then the article goes on to say, that sounds a lot like defund the police.
Yeah, Jonathan, I guess that's a question.
Yeah.
God bless The Root. It's nice to have them on my side every blue moon. I'm not sure I would go with their conclusions, but yes, it is important for us to use the resources that we provide to law enforcement in a way to get them to compel them towards the direction that we think is in the best interest of the nation, of the communities that they serve, and frankly, of the officers themselves. And so what we try to do is bridge that gap. One of the areas that he's probably referring to is the importance of body cameras. 5 years ago, I started this journey after the Walter Scott shooting in North Charleston. A man was shot in the back 5 times, and then there was a false police report that brought us to a conclusion that was inconsistent with reality, period. Had we had the type of resources in place, I think we can prevent more of these deaths and certainly have enhanced penalties for falsified police reports. That's not in the House bill. It's only exclusively in our bill. The false police report has an enhanced penalty on top of the SBI, serious bodily injury or death, that leads to prosecution. So it's really important for us to bring more emphasis on character-driven law enforcement. If we miss that, we miss the entire.
That's from Senator Tim Scott yesterday on ABC's This Week. Well, on to campaign 2020, a number of key primaries tomorrow that will test whether the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is gaining electoral strength. In just a moment, we'll talk to Max Greenwood, who's been following that story for The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. But first, in one of those Democratic primaries, the race to get the nomination in order to challenge Republican Senator Mitch McConnell. He is the GOP leader, of course. The race includes State Representative Charles Booker and his Democratic rival, former Marine pilot Amy McGrath. Here are some of the ads now on the air in Kentucky.
I'm running for U.S. Senate because in this crisis, Kentucky needs a real Democrat to take on Mitch McConnell. Someone who will fight to guarantee health care and living wages for all and not help Trump just get his way.
And that's going to be, you know, my message, that the things that Kentuckians voted for Trump for are not being done.
I'm Charles Booker, and I approve this message because Democrats only win by mobilizing young and old, black, brown, and white, fighting for real change. And together, that's exactly what we'll do.
Growing up, I was so proud to be from Northern Kentucky. Whether it was going to Riverfront Stadium or the 4th of July in Edgewood, our mom and dad taught us to be good citizens, to believe in God, and to wave our flag with pride. They taught me I could be anything in life and to serve for the greater good. I'm Amy McGrath, and I approve this message because I'll be a senator who never forgets Northern Kentucky.
Just some of the ads now on the air in Kentucky in advance of tomorrow's Democratic primary. This headline at thehill.com, the left eyeing a huge night in Kentucky and in the New York primaries. Max Greenwood is joining us on the phone. And let's begin with this Kentucky primary race, because Amy McGrath was, up until a few weeks ago, the odds-on favorite to win the nomination. What are you reporting on tonight?
Well, I mean, what I'm really looking at, and, you know, I want to point out, you say she was the odds-on favorite to win, and, you know, to an extent, I'd say that's still the case. So what I'm really interested in looking at right now is kind of the structural issues in this race. Obviously, Representative Booker's had a few really good weeks. He's got a lot of momentum, got some great endorsements, raised a lot of money. But, you know, voters in Kentucky have been mailing in ballots for a few weeks now, and one thing I'm interested in seeing is how much does that capture Booker's recent surge in the race? So a lot of ballots may have been sent in before he started getting the attention he's gotten, before he's had the money, before he's gone on air. So that could work against him. And I think the other thing, too, is just the kind of dearth of precincts open in Kentucky tomorrow. So in Jefferson County, where Booker is from, there's only one precinct open. And granted, it's a very large one. It's the Kentucky Expo Center. But, you know, there, as we've seen in several primaries recently, there have been a lot of hiccups on Election Day. So that may hurt him as well. I think that being said, you know, seems to be peaking at the right time. I think a lot of Democrats out in Kentucky are impressed with him. He really speaks to the moment. He's been at protests. He's called for defunding the police. He's called for these reforms that are getting so much attention right now. So I think that puts him just in the right place.
And, of course, the winner in that race will challenge the incumbent Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. The other big race tomorrow evening is New York's 16th Congressional District, Congressman Elliot Engel. He's the veteran from that seat, the current chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, but facing a real challenge from Jamal Bowman. Who is he?
Well, Jamal Bowman is a former middle school principal. He is he's backed by Representative Ocasio-Cortez and the Justice Democrats. He's backed by Bernie Sanders, and he's definitely trying to take up that progressive lane. I think what's really interesting about that right now is just to kind of know where that district is. So it's New York's 16th district. It's the Northern Bronx and then Southern Westchester County. So it is it's a diverse district. Jamal Bowman is from the Bronx, and I think he speaks to a lot of the working class voters there. You know, Representative Engel is still a huge presence in the district. He's well known. He's been there for 30 plus years at this point. And I think that's going to be a really interesting race, just because it is, it says a lot about the state of the Democratic Party in its purest form. So it's not a seat that's going to be contested by Republicans, at least not seriously. I think Democrats have held on to it for something like 50 years at this point. But, you know, it says a lot about the divide in that district between the changing Bronx and then the more affluent parts of Westchester County.
And Max Greenwood, it really goes back to the election 2 years ago when Joe Crowley was expected to win renomination. And along came Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, not only upending that race, but really creating a real presence on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we keep talking about, you know, is Elliot Engel going to be the next Joe Crowley? I think Joe Crowley's defeat a couple of years ago really, you know, the time was unexpected. There was, you know, this organizer and bartender from, you know, New York who's challenging a 10-term incumbent. I don't think anybody really thought to give her the time of day at that point, but she has become such a huge presence, you know, in Democratic politics and in Washington. You know, and this race in New York 16, this Engel race, echoes that in a lot of ways. And certainly Ocasio-Cortez hasn't been shy about getting involved in that and speaking up on that.
The story is available this evening at thehill.com, the reporting of Max Greenwood. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
On Wall Street for this Monday, a good day for the markets. The Dow gaining 153 points. The NASDAQ rose 110, and the S&P was up 21. A reminder, this program is available as a podcast. You can find it by searching Washington Today wherever you get your podcasts, or better yet, go to our website at cspan.org/podcasts. I'm Steve Scully in our nation's capital for this Monday, June 22nd. Thanks for being with us. I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.